I guess we're starting a little late these days, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, I will get my 5 minutes back. Let me start by reviewing my plan for the future here. So today, my goal is to discuss how to compute correlation functions of primary operators in the vacuum state of a CFT using holography, using ADS CFT. And I'll talk about both Euclidean correlators and Lorentzian correlators in real time. Hopefully in a unified way, which is useful. Tomorrow, which I guess is called Wednesday, my goal is to talk about thermodynamics and a little bit of hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics from holography, including the calculation of the shear viscosity in the plasma that you get by taking a CFT that has a gravity dual and putting it at a finite temperature. And Thursday will be a particularly interesting day. I will not give a lecture on Thursday because Tammy and I are going to... She needs to do something else on Friday, and so she's going to give two lectures on Thursday, and I'm going to give two lectures on Friday. Okay? So Thursday I will be Tammy. And Friday, there will be two of me, and one of me will be at 10:15. The subject will be finite charge density. That is, how do we describe some finite amount of stuff using holography? I want to spend some time talking about holographic Fermi surfaces. So this is my plan. If you have strong opinions about other things you want to hear about, or subsets of these things that you don't want to hear about, let me know. There's still some time to change the course of the future. All right. Are there any questions about the plan, about where we are, about things we've said so far? That's okay? All right, so last time, when last we spoke, we were in the middle of talking about the wave equation, the scalar wave equation, the equation of motion for a scalar field in anti de Sitter space. And we explained that it was okay to study a linear equation even if the field has self-interactions, because our current interest is in small fluctuations, is in computing, say, two-point functions of fluctuations about a CFT vacuum, where the field sits at some equilibrium point, and so the fluctuations are small. We could ignore terms in the action which are cubic or higher order in them, and this equation in momentum space, we can go to momentum space because the system is translation invariant and the equation is linear, and so we can study the equation mode by mode. That is, for each k, the mode of momentum k satisfies this equation. This is an ordinary differential equation as a function of the radial coordinate. So this function fk of z is the kth Fourier mode of this scalar field in anti de Sitter space, and the equation of motion says this. And we discovered that this equation, the solutions of this equation, are power laws near the boundary, near the boundary of ADS at z goes to zero. That is, plugging the following ansatz, fk of z goes like z to the delta into this equation, we learn that for small z, that this is a solution if delta satisfied, if we choose delta, if we choose the exponent here to satisfy, delta delta minus d is m squared l squared. And this is a relation that I was trying to show, but the thing I need to convince you is that this delta plays the role of the scaling dimension of this of the corresponding operator, of the operator in the CFT corresponding to this field. So more mathematical language, I can't even say the word. This statement is that the point z equals 0 is a regular singular point of this differential equation. And there's this very elaborate 19th century mathematical physics structure for studying such things, which I guess is usually called the method of Frobenius. And the more precise statement is that the solution, an arbitrary solution of this equation in a neighborhood of z equals 0 has an expansion of the following form. It says that it's equal to z to the delta plus times some coefficient, let's call it a, times some series, some Taylor series with a finite radius of convergence in z, with some coefficients here, which I won't even give them names. Let's just say plus order z squared. And so there's one solution like this, and there's another solution like this. Where it's important to distinguish two things. A and B here are integration constants, right? This is a second order linear ordinary differential equation in z, and so they're in order to specify a solution, I need to say I need to give two pieces of initial data. The coefficients in the series expansion, on the other hand, are completely determined by the differential equation. And so these numbers here are determined by the ODE, and in general will depend on k and all the other data in there. They'll depend on k. But notice that delta does not depend on k. So, these are two solutions. A and B are the initial data. And more precisely, it'll be important for us later that these expansions define, in fact, Bessel functions. They're series expansions of some known function, but that won't be so important for a few minutes. Yes?
So how do we know that delta is the same delta that's the dimension?
We don't. Yeah, I haven't given any evidence for that statement yet.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to show you that still. Good. Yeah, that's the next question on the table. And so I guess I should say delta plus minus are the two roots of this equation. Delta plus minus is d over 2 plus or minus square root d over 2 squared plus m squared l squared. So this is just using the quadratic formula. And let me make some comments about these two roots. Comments about the roots. First of all, notice that the solution that goes like z to the delta minus, so delta minus is smaller than delta plus, right? Because we're subtracting something positive from d over 2. And so the solution that goes like delta minus near z goes to 0 is bigger, right? If we have a number smaller than 1, if you like, think of it as z over l to the delta minus. The z over l to the delta minus solution is bigger, is the bigger one near z goes to 0. The smaller power of a small number is bigger. The second comment is delta plus is always positive, right? For all values of m, delta plus is a positive thing. And so that means z to the delta plus always goes to 0 at the boundary. The delta minus solution doesn't necessarily go to 0. Sometimes this thing we're subtracting is bigger than this. Third comment which is useful to keep in mind, is that the sum of the roots is equal to d. Right? If you add these two things, this cancels, you get two of these, it's equal to d. And so the picture looks, there's a picture which is useful to draw, something like this. If I draw versus m squared l squared, the spectrum of deltas we get, it looks something like, it's a parabola, right, which goes through 0, delta equals 0 when when m equals 0, and the other place where m equals 0 is d, and then here's d over 2, and here is m squared is minus d squared over 4. Right, so what I mean by delta plus is this top branch, and delta minus is this bottom branch. Yes, please.
How do we know which of those deltas will be the scaling dimension of the
other? We don't yet. Yes, this is an excellent question. Right. Right. In fact, we don't know yet that either of them will be. So this is a very good question to keep in mind. In fact, it's sometimes ambiguous. In fact, sometimes either of them can be taken to be the scaling dimension. And we can construct two different CFTs in this way. So the first lesson that we learned from this calculation, though, is that we want to impose boundary conditions on our wave equation that allow solutions. So this is sort of a minimal requirement when trying to figure out which boundary conditions to impose in your wave equation. Right, it's not such a great idea to impose boundary conditions for which there are no solutions. And so previously, you'll recall that I wrote some equation like phi of z and x approaches, approaches phi naught of x near the boundary. Right, I wrote something like this as our boundary condition. But of course, that's not a solution. So that when z goes to 0, for general values of mass, a better thing to do is to impose phi of z and x at z equals epsilon. Remember, epsilon is our cutoff boundary. So I could call this, in general, this is some function of epsilon and x, this boundary value at, I guess it's really just this. It's some function of epsilon and x. But a much better thing to impose would be that the bigger, it behave like the bigger possible solution. Some epsilon, so that it should behave like epsilon to the delta minus times something that's purely a function of x, which is a different function than the one before. Let me give it a superscript, renormalized. I'd like you to think of this as the renormalized source. So this thing is some source for the corresponding operator, which depends on the cutoff. Here we figured out how it should depend on the cutoff in order to get a good solution. And so a heuristic but very useful picture of what's happening there is that this is wave function renormalization. So consider the following thing. So I claim that this is wave function renormalization of the operators. That is, this familiar idea that when you're renormalizing the quantum field theory, in general, you have to rescale your operators by some function of the cutoff in order that they have finite correlation functions. And so consider that we want to add to our action of the boundary theory, we want it to contain some term like an integral at the boundary as z equals epsilon, an integral over the boundary space with the boundary metric, whatever it is, of this renormalized source times, in general, some cutoff-dependent version of the operator. What I mean by this gamma, by the way, is this is a notation I'll use a couple of times today, is the metric near the boundary looks something like this. So there's a bit normal to the boundary, and then there's the metric on the boundary. So with this definition comparing to the metric on ADS, what I mean by gamma mu nu is just L squared over epsilon squared eta mu nu. Okay, so this is just the statement that we want to add to the action of the field theory, some source for the operator O, which is determined by the boundary value of the field. But now I'm doing two things. One is allowing for the possibility that our operators can have some cutoff dependence, that is this wave function normalization. And I'm also engaging in something that maybe is a fiction, namely that the field theory actually lives on the cutoff surface. Right? So this is something that perhaps you should consider to be a heuristic. But it's a useful heuristic, which often gives correct correct answers. And so let me just plug in the formula for square root of g and the behavior of this phi naught that we just figured out. So this is some integral over space, over space-time. The square root of gamma is just L over epsilon to the d. Right, that's just the determinant of this matrix, square root. And this renormalized source is, what is it? We just figured out it should be epsilon to the delta minus phi naught renormalized of x. And notice I picked epsilon to the delta minus rather than delta plus because of this statement. Right? The behavior near the boundary, which is bigger, is the one with the delta minus. And so that we should think of that as the sort of big thing that we should hold fixed. And then finally, there's this O of x comma epsilon. And now we get to pick how we define our operators, how they depend on the cutoff. And so notice that if we define, let's say if we demand that this is finite, if we demand that this thing, this term in this boundary action is less than infinity, when the cutoff goes away, then you see, this sort of requires us to take the cutoff dependence of this operator to be some power law, which cancels these powers of epsilon. And it should be epsilon to the, what is it, d minus delta minus times some renormalized operator that's independent of the cutoff. So that this here was chosen to cancel this factor of epsilon to the minus d and epsilon to the delta minus. And notice that by this relation here, d minus delta minus is delta plus. Yes? Say again? From here, from the square root of gamma. Yeah, so with this definition of the boundary metric, the square root of gamma, by which I mean the square root of the determinant of this matrix, absolute value, is the square root of L over epsilon to the d, right? It's a d by d matrix, each of whose diagonal entries is L over epsilon squared. So this is L over epsilon to the d. The 2d, right? This is L over epsilon to the d. All right, so this is my evidence for the statement that if we pick the source to be the bigger solution, the coefficient of the bigger solution of the wave equation in the bulk, that is, if we pick the field at the boundary to behave like this, with this boundary condition that it goes like epsilon to the delta minus, z to the delta minus, then the scaling dimension of the operator, that is, how does the operator rescale when we change our cutoff, should be delta plus. So this is a strong piece of evidence that delta plus is the dimension of the operator. So this is this means strongly suggests delta plus is the scaling dimension. Of the operator dual to phi.
So is this still in the IDA space, or is it the CFT?
This is the reason I wrote this word. So this whole thing is evaluated on this cutoff surface at z equals epsilon, right? Which, it's not really clear that there is something called O living there, right? And that's why this is heuristic. But if we do imagine that the field theory lives there, this conclusion follows. So if you like a much more direct and less thought-provoking argument for the statement is, well, we could just use this prescription to calculate the two-point functions of the operator, and we'll see that. Simpler conceptually, but harder in terms of how many symbols we have to write, is just to compute the two-point function of this operator and see that it goes like 1 over x to the 2 delta, which 2 delta plus. So this is, dimensional analysis then says that if the operator O has scaling dimension delta, then its two-point function had better go like 1 over x to the 2 delta. We'll see how directly we can do this. In fact, our next goal is to figure out how to do this. So this heuristic calculation will be confirmed by a sharper one. But before we do that, let me make some comments that we can already see from this statement. Yeah. Yes. Then this calculation would have we could have done this calculation and we would have found delta minus here, right? Because you know the problem is symmetrical in delta plus and delta minus, except there is a bit of a there is a reason to choose delta minus to be the source, which is that it's the bigger one, and in fact. The possibility of choosing delta plus to be the source only exists in a certain window of values of the mass. You can see from here? Where?
You said the top and bottom branches of delta plus and delta minus.
Okay, good. So you're saying if we pick...
Well, the delta minus branch goes all the way through the positive ends. The delta plus branch stops.
Well, no, they both exist only in the same range. They both only exist for m squared bigger than this value. Let me see if just from this... This is meant to be a parabola, by the way. let me see if just from this information we can say... The issue is normalizability. If... We want the boundary condition we pick to be something that doesn't fluctuate. Right, I mean that's sort of the that's a little bit tautological. If in the same way that saying that the boundary of the asymptotic behavior of the spacetime is one of the boundary conditions, and the reason that we can pick it as a boundary condition is because it's sort of frozen; it doesn't fluctuate. If delta minus is, I guess it, yeah, here we go. If delta minus is negative, actually, then the fact that it falls off so quickly, the fact that solution falls off so quickly near the boundary. In fact, means that there's no well-posed problem where you fix it as its coefficient as the boundary condition. The other mode is never normalizable. I guess is the better statement. Maybe I shouldn't say too much more about this. Let me just give a reference which can clarify this. This question of choosing the other boundary condition is called, it's sometimes called alternative quantization. And is the subject of a paper by Klebanov and Witten, which is HEPTH 9908. Okay, I don't know the last three numbers.
what's the dimension of phi naught to normalize?
Dimension of phi naught? Do you mean engineering dimension?
Yeah.
We can figure it out from the definition, right? Sorry, I'm not sure what you mean.
Because you say that O has very normalized O as a dimension of delta plus, but
you're
that
worried,
must be from
you're worried at,
being dimension.
You're worried about the dimensional analysis on this formula?
Yeah.
I've left out some factors of the ADS radius. So really there's a 1 over L ADS here,
okay.
and probably here too. I'm taking advantage of the fact that the ADS radius has to drop out of every answer in the field theory calculation to allow myself to ignore it, and so I'm not always very careful about it. Do the powers work out now?
Not sure.
I think the basic idea you should have in mind is that these two things have dimensions so that, you know, which are conjugate to each other, so their dimensions differ by d length dimensions, and then everything else just has to work out. Yeah, so I think it should work now. All right, good. Dimensional analysis is a good thing to worry about. All right, so now I want to talk about the subject of relevantness. Um, So in this formula for delta plus minus, let me just write it again. Well, there are some interesting cases to consider. If m squared is positive, so that is on this side of the picture, then delta plus, what we would like to think of as the scaling dimension of the operator, is bigger than d, which means that when we add this term to the action, we should think of this thing as its coupling constant that says that as we go towards the infrared, it goes away. This statement that the scaling dimension is bigger than d is the statement that O is an irrelevant operator. Right, that's the definition, which becomes less and less important in the infrared. Let me just say it again. That's the statement that when we add to the action, this operator, its coefficient, is something with dimensions of mass to some power, which is which goes like d minus delta, which goes away for energies when we ask questions about energies less than this mass scale that appears there, this big mass scale. And so this thing that plays the role of this coupling that goes to zero in the infrared is exactly this field, is exactly the is this field phi of z, the behavior of the field in the bulk. And notice that the statement that phi of z goes away in the infrared has a converse, which is that it grows in the UV. That's just the statement that it goes like z to the delta minus. Z to the delta minus, which is where delta minus is negative, which means that this goes to infinity near the boundary. And so that's the statement that if we did turn on this coupling as a finite perturbation, and not just as like a some little infinitesimal kick that we do to compute the two-point function, if we really did add this to the action with some finite coefficient, this we couldn't ignore the back reaction of this because it blows up near the boundary. So a finite such phi naught for such a field destroys the ADS asymptotics. It destroys the conformal symmetry in the ultraviolet. And this is exactly what you expect of an irrelevant operator that is trying to take a quantum field theory and perturb it by an irrelevant operator is something that's not well defined in the sense that this is what one means by some non-renormalizable coupling in a field theory. It means that you need extra data to specify what happens at short distances, right? That if you do it naively, you'll run into all kinds of ultraviolet divergences, the result of which isn't specified by the information at hand, and rather you need to supply more data. And the gravity dual of the statement is that something else happens to the geometry near the boundary here, which you would have to include more information about what happens at short distances to figure out what that is. Okay, more data required. Okay, on the other hand, so then the next case is m squared equals zero. So m squared equals zero is the marginal case. This says delta is equal to d, and O is a marginal operator. Not necessarily exactly marginal, but infinitesimally adding it to the action doesn't require the introduction of any dimensionful quantity. And finally, the other case is n squared less than zero. And this says delta is less than d. Now, from the point of view of the field and the bulk, you might think saying that its mass squared is negative should mean that there's an instability. Right, in thinking about fields in flat space, if you see a field whose potential looks like this, this is what it means for the mass squared to be negative, you might think that it would try to roll off the top of the hill and would represent an instability. But what one means by an instability is a mode of the field that grows spontaneously in time, right? That is, even without any, without perturbing it all, it will nevertheless, that is, without a source, there'll be some normalizable mode, some allowed fluctuation of the system, which grows in time. And that doesn't happen here. And the reason, at least it doesn't happen if m squared is not too negative. And the reason it doesn't happen is that the field near the boundary, as we've said, is constrained to go like z to the delta minus, or maybe z to the delta plus. And this goes in this range, this goes to zero near the boundary. And the fact that the field is constrained to vanish at the boundary means that in order for it to condense, in order for it to roll down the hill somewhere in the at finite z, there would have to be some gradient energy, right? Because it's zero here and it wants to be large here, and that means it has to vary in between, and that costs some finite amount of energy from the fact that there's gradient phi squared terms in the action. And so that means that unless the potential is really, really steep, unless it's steep in a way that's large compared to 1 over L, the ADS radius, it in fact won't condense. And so the value where it becomes too steep is in fact for m squared is this thing called the Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound, which is this. The fact that something very bad happens there and not before it is indicated by also the fact that something bad happens there is indicated by the fact that for instability. So for m squared less than this Brayton-Lohner-Friedman bound, the scaling dimensions are of the form I times a real number. So imaginary scaling dimensions indicate that something is wrong. But for m squared between here and here, this is just for m squared in this range, this just says the delta is a relevant operator. That is, its effects become unimportant in the ultraviolet. That's this statement. The field goes to zero near the boundary, near the UV boundary, but its effects become important towards the infrared, towards large z. One more comment, which is that this relationship between the dimension and the mass, we derived for the case of a scalar field, doing this detailed study of the wave equation, there's a similar but a little bit different relation for fields of other spin. So, for example, for a vector field, the relation has some extra constant in there. For a vector field in ADS, so this is some a mu, the relation is delta times, delta minus d plus 3 is equal to m squared l squared. And so one reason I mentioned that is that if you set m equal to 0 here, it says that the dimension of the vector field, well, rather the dimension of the current that's dual to this vector field, so I call it J because this says that the boundary action by the same kind of heuristic we were talking about before has a term that's like the boundary value of this vector field times something with a single index, which I might as well call a current. But it's only a conserved current in this case, because in this case, when m equals 0, the dimension of J is, what is it? It's d plus 3. Is that right? That's not right. Oh. Okay, I have a typo in my notes. You should. Sorry. Okay, I think so. there's some number here. The correct answer for the case of a conserved current is d minus 1. And so this is true if and only if the current is conserved. So a massless gauge field in the bulk implies that is dual to a conserved current on the boundary. And maybe you'll have an opportunity to derive this relation on the homework. I hope. Yes?
Is it an irrelevant operator?
Remind you, what is an irrelevant operator? So it means that the dimension of the operator is bigger than d, right? Because then when you add it to the action, its coefficient is something with dimensions of mass to some negative power.
It's one that will become more important, less important at high energies?
No, it becomes less important at low energies. Right, so yeah, irrelevant is the terminology is from the point of view of someone who's interested in low energies. Yeah. Which, is what most experiments, alas, are. Okay, good. All right, so now let's return to the wave equation and think about the vacuum of the Euclidean vacuum of a conformal field theory. So far we've been talking about boundary conditions in the ultraviolet, but to specify a solution of this wave equation, we need one more boundary condition. So let's return to the vacuum of CFT, and let's think about the Euclidean case. Euclidean case. Okay, so I'll write the scalar wave equation again. I'm not going to write the scalar wave equation again. Picture in your mind the scalar wave equation that I wrote before. All right, I'll just write it. Okay, so the distinction between Euclidean and Lorentzian appears only in this K here. So what I mean by this K is, you know, K squared is K mu K nu, and then, you know, so in Euclidean space this is a delta mu nu rather than a eta mu nu. More generally, well, let me just call it eta, and you can think of it as positive or not. So what I mean by Euclidean is either suppose that the signature is all plus, or just suppose that this is positive. So the only appearance of it, the only way in which this case is distinguished from the Lorentzian case is by the sign of k squared. So this, everything I'll say will be the same if we're considering the Lorentzian case, but with space-like momentum. Okay, so just the important thing is let's consider the case where this is positive. So if this is true, then the general solution of this differential equation happens to be, and this is something that even Mathematica can tell you, is some integration constant a sub k times z to the d over 2 times Bessel k sub nu of kz, where k is, this k, by the way, is square root of k squared, the k that appears there, and then plus some a, let's call it a sub I, z to the d over 2 Bessel I sub nu of kz. So Bessel k and Bessel k are two, Bessel I are two Bessel functions. And nu is by definition delta minus d over 2, delta plus minus d over 2, that is just the square root piece, d squared, d over 2 squared plus m squared l squared. Okay, so in the case of empty de Sitter space, the scalar wave equation is analytically solvable, and these are the solutions. And a consistency condition on the set of things I'm telling you is that the behavior of this near z equals 0 is a power law that goes like z to the nu, because you see then this goes like, oh, sorry, is the, yeah, that's right, z to the plus or minus nu, because you see then this whole thing goes like z to the d over 2 plus or minus nu, which is delta, and so does this. So that's a fact about Bessel functions. And so that, you know, that was just a consistency condition. But then the new data that we get, it's okay? This is a D. Okay. Ask questions. Ask questions.
And that's sort of like something that we saw in this session.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay. All right. Okay. So the fact that the boundary behavior is as it has to be is not a surprise. The new data from the fact that we know these solutions is the infrared behavior, the behavior near z goes to infinity. That is the result of integrating this equation all the way to z goes to infinity. And near that locus, these two Bessel functions behave very differently. In particular, Bessel k nicely dies off. It goes like e to the minus kz. Is that right? Yeah. But Bessel I blows up. And so if we're interested in solutions where the behavior is regular, the behavior of the solution everywhere in the interior is regular, this uniquely forces us to choose the coefficient of Bessel I to vanish. And so this regularity of this Euclidean solution, that is that it doesn't blow up, forces us to pick a sub I equals 0. And so that solution can't be part of the solution. And I claim I'm not gonna do it in front of you because there's a better way to do it that we'll talk about it in a second. But I claim that plugging this into the formula z is e to the minus classical action of the scalar field, plugging this solution, this is the solution. Let me put an underline. And taking two derivatives as a function of the source produces this behavior and Fourier transforming. So there's a whole bunch of steps that I just said there, which I'm not going to do because it's something that one should do more privately than this. But I'll show you a better way to think about how to get this result. And I guess one more comment I should make about this Euclidean case is that this idea that in the Euclidean section, regularity of the solution uniquely determines which fixes the integration constant is a very general phenomenon. And in fact, in ADS, there's even a nonlinear version of the statement. That is, there's this thing called the Gram-Lee theorem that says that if you pick a metric on the round sphere, not too far away from, sorry, pick a metric on the sphere, not necessarily the round one, not too far away from the round one, then there's a unique metric on metric with constant negative curvature, which fills in the ball inside of that sphere, right? So you should think of, here's the bound. This is the surface of the ball. You pick some gamma mu nu here, on here, which it can be a function of x, and then this Gram-Lee theorem uniquely determines a metric in the interior, which satisfies the ADS, which is locally ADS. So that's that's solving some very complicated nonlinear Einstein's equations here, and so this is just some simple linear version of that much bigger, fancier statement. Okay, but the idea is the same, that regularity of the solution uniquely fixes it. Okay. Okay, so that was Euclidean. Now let me talk about Lorentzian, which real-time Green's functions have a reputation of being a subtle and horrible thing, but the holographic prescription is actually very simple. So now suppose. So what I mean by this is suppose that we allow this to be negative. So that is, suppose that 0 is bigger than k squared, which is k mu k nu, eta mu nu, and I'm in the signature where this is minus omega squared plus k squared. Right, as you could have seen from there. So that means so the frequency decreases the forward momentum, the square of the forward momentum. So saying that this is negative says the frequency is bigger than the momentum, which is the statement that this can be some on-shell excitation, that is some real propagating degree of freedom. Okay, and in this case, there are many solutions. There are many solutions of this equation, if we put a minus sign here, which all have the same nice UV behavior. Okay, star, let's call it a star, which all have the same nice UV behavior, but different infrared behavior. And more or less, they're of the following form. They're of the form fk of z is z to the d over 2, k plus or minus nu of iqz. And the important difference here is just this I, where q is just the thing that q is just this. This is just I times the thing I called k squared before. Sorry, the thing I called k before. And so that's why there's an iq here, where previously there was just a k. And in the infrared, when z goes to infinity, each of these behaves like e to the plus or minus iqz. Can anybody tell me how you could have known that it behaved this way without doing any calculation? So what is the thing that behaves? What is the? Tell me a context where the solutions of the wave equation look like this. Look like e to the I something space.
One dimension.
Well, oh yeah, okay, right. So, but it could, you know, it could have been something like that. But, yeah. What did you? Somebody said it.
Flat
space. That's right. Exactly right. So in flat space, you know, this is a plane wave, and it's not too surprising that the behavior of the wave equation near z goes to infinity looks like flat space, because the metric is locally flat space near z goes to infinity. The only special place in ADS is the boundary, because you know, let's look at the metric in ADS. It's dz squared over z squared plus the Minkowski metric, right? And near z goes to zero, something funny happens, right? Because this blows up. You know, this is some singularity of the metric. But near z goes to infinity, this is just some, you know, at some large value of z, I can just set z to some constant. That's just some number from the point of view of propagation in the z direction. And the bits we care about are just the z in the t direction. And so, you know, this is just some number here. And so it's really just flat space. And so it's not at all surprising that this is the behavior. And the fact that this z is going to infinity is the fact that this is sometimes called the Poincaré horizon. It's called a horizon just because the coefficient of the metric in the dt, in the coefficient of gtt is going to zero. But it's really a very innocuous place. It's just like flat space. So this behavior isn't surprising, but we're still left with this multiplicity of solutions in this real-time case. Whereas in this case, you know, just demanding that the solution didn't blow up uniquely fixed the solution. But I claim that this is exactly as it should be, that this multiplicity of solutions of the wave equation reflects the multiplicity of possible real-time Green's functions that we might want to compute. And so if we had found a unique solution, we would have been screwed, because then we wouldn't be able to compute all the Green's functions we should be able to compute. So I claim that this is a good thing, because there are many different real-time Green's functions, and of which different ones arise in different contexts. The one that we'll be perhaps the most interested in, and which is perhaps the most interesting for at least the most straightforward kinds of experiments, is the retarded Green's functions. So for example, there are retarded Green's functions, there are advanced Green's functions, there's Whiteman functions, there's all kinds of horrible stuff that whose names I can never remember. But let's focus on this one. And the important thing about the retarded Green's function is that it describes the causal response of the system. It's if you kick the system with some operator, and the retarded Green's function measures the actual response in real time later on of the system by in the measurement of the of some other operator, in general other operator. So to what extent have you encountered this statement in the other courses? For example, in the condensed matter courses. Usually there's some long business in a condensed matter course describing linear response theory and giving some arduous and horrible discussion of the relationship between Green's retarded Green's functions and linear response. Okay. So maybe it's profitable to spend a little bit of time on understanding the nature of the retarded Green's function. Yeah? Okay. You understand that there's an opportunity cost in doing this. Okay. Right, so that's also in this list of things. Yes.
We won't worry about that?
We could. So you can construct that from these guys. What can I say in response to this? Well, let me talk about this one, and maybe you'll see why I'm talking about it. Okay, so let me say some words about linear response. What I mean by the retarded Green's function, for given two operators, let me call them O sub A and O sub B, the retarded Green's function in frequency space is the following thing. The definition is there's some factor of I that's conventional. It's an integral over, I mean, this integral I'm writing is really just a Fourier transform. E to the I omega t minus k dot x of, okay, so now there's two things to notice. First of all, there's a theta function in time. And then secondly, there's a commutator. So A, the first argument, is inserted at time t and position x, and B is inserted at the origin. And I guess I'm assuming that the state we're studying is translation invariant in time and space, so that we can fix some point without loss of generality. So the two things to notice are the commutator, which I'll explain next, and the theta function. The theta function encodes the fact that if the insertion of the operator A precedes the insertion of the operator B, nothing happens. And so we should think of A, so think of O sub B as the source. Sorry, theta of t is, by the way, this function, right? It's one for t bigger than zero and zero for t less than zero. This is a theta, not an O. So it says that, right, this is zero if t is negative, right, that it's if A precedes B. And so think of B as the source and A as the response. This is part of the definition. Okay, so there's this theta function, there's this commutator. And I claim that the reason to care about this is that it determines the response in the expectation value of O sub A to kicking the system at time t equals zero with O sub B. And so to see that, let's think about adding to our Hamiltonian of the system some time-dependent bit, which is the following. So this is why. I'm going to explain why we define this thing. So add to the Hamiltonian some function that we get to pick, phi sub b zero. So this is encoding what perturbation we make, and the operator that we're adding is this operator O sub b. And if you like, think of this thing as, think of this as a delta function at t equals 0, x equals 0. So that's why the operator will be inserted at 0, 0 there. And then let's ask, what is the expectation? So given this perturbation of the Hamiltonian, this is describing, you know, your foot kicking the system. Your foot couples to the system by the operator LSB, and you kick it at this, you know, with this profile of you know, this is non-zero during the time when your foot is in contact with the system, and your foot is at this position. Okay, and the thing we're interested in measuring is the expectation of the operator O sub A as a result of that. So this is in the presence of this perturbation. And well, the definition of this expectation value, just so notice that everything I'm going to say is just facts from quantum mechanics. There's nothing fancy at all in what I'm telling you. So it's just trace of the density matrix that this puts the system in times O sub A. This is, if you like, the definition of density of expectation value. And now let's we can write this more conveniently. If we we're going to think of this as a small perturbation, right? We're going to think about what happens to linear order in the size of this perturbation. And so it's useful to use this interaction picture, that is to write this expectation value here as trace of rho naught u inverse of t OA of t comma x u of t. Let's see, and what did I do here? I wrote rho naught is some density matrix for the state that we're studying, which maybe is the thermal state. So H naught is the Hamiltonian that we perturbed with this thing here. So that is H, the whole Hamiltonian is H naught plus delta H. And so if you wanted to study the ground state, just take this beta to infinity. And U, the matrix U here, is just a time-ordered product of e to the minus I integral up to time t of the perturbation Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is just, you can figure out what the density matrix is at time t by time evolving the initial density matrix, just integrating the Schrodinger equation. All of this follows just from the Schrodinger equation. Okay? So finally, as I said, we're interested in only in the linear change. And so let's think about the linear change of O sub A as a function of t and x. That is, O sub A as a function of t and x. In the presence of, the linear order in phi naught change in the expectation value. I'm going to expand this exponential here. It appears here and here, to linear order in phi naught, which appears in this delta h, right? In this perturbation, and what I get is minus I. The minus I comes from here, times trace rho naught integral up to t dt prime, and there's two terms. There's one from expanding this guy, and there's the one from expanding this guy, and they have a relative minus sign because of that inverse, and so I get a commutator. So I'm expanding to linear order in the perturbing Hamiltonian, which, and now let me plug in the definition of the perturbing Hamiltonian. So I'm plugging in delta H is integral phi times O, O sub B. So this was just plugging in for delta H. And so And what's left here is just a convolution of over this x prime of the retarded Green's function as a function of x and x prime. And I guess this is an integral over d coordinates of this source function. So, and I say this based on comparing this expression with our definition. So this is this object g sub r of x and x prime is the Fourier transform of this object. And so, right, Fourier transforming back, the thing we learned from this arduous exercise in quantum mechanics, it really is arduous. I mean, there's lots of writing. Is that the change in the expectation of the frequency space operator O sub A is this retarded Green's function that I wrote here, O sub A, O sub B, times the momentum space, the frequency and momentum space source. So that is, if we Fourier transform this expression, this convolution turns into a product. Right? Fourier transform turns convolutions into products, and so we get this expression. So that is to say, if you kick the system with the operator B, with this frequency and this momentum, the response of the operator A at this frequency momentum is determined by this retarded Green's function. And so let's do an example, since this was rather abstract. Consider the case where the perturbation is an external electric field. So say E sub X. So let me emphasize, we're not in an empty Sitter space, we're in the real world. This is like an actual electric field with like a capacitor. So suppose you turn on this electric field, I can pick a gauge so that it looks like that in terms of some A sub X. This couples to the reason I write it in terms of A sub X is because this couples to say the electric current by a term in the Hamiltonian, which is like integral S of x, J sub x. This is the electric current. So this says that O sub B, the thing by which I'm perturbing the system, so this is the analog of this phi sub B naught. This is the analog of O sub B. The way by which I perturb the system is O sub B is the electric current, J sub x. And that's the perturbation. And then the response, well, one example of a response is also the electric current. So that is, suppose we turn on an electric field and we measure the electric current. This is something that people do. Then we expect if the thing is a conductor, we expect to find some kind of Ohm's law. J is equal to sigma times E, right? And so let's compare that to our general statement of a linear response. Right, so this is our expectation. In fact, this is the definition of sigma. Let's just say this is the definition of the conductivity sigma. Then let's compare that to our general formula. So the general formula is, well, O sub J, I guess I could just call it J, the expectation of the current as a function of frequency and momentum is according to this formula. And I guess I'm going to assume delta J is equal to J. That is, in the absence of an electric field, there's no current, right? This is OK. So I can just, rather than writing delta O here, I can just write J. According to the formula we just derived, this is the retarded Green's function of, well, O sub B is equal to J and O sub A is equal to J. It's the retarded two-point function of J times the perturbing, so the thing we're supposed to write here is the perturbing thing, that's A sub X, which A sub X is related to the perturbing electric field in this way. So this is G, the retarded Green's function of the current times E, the electric field, over I omega. Right, that's, I just divided by I omega. And so combining this relation here for the response of the current to an electric field to this relation involving the Green's function, we derive the statement that the conductivity as a function of frequency and momentum is this retarded two-point function of the current over I omega. And this formula is called the Kubo formula. And so you might care about the retarded Green's functions, for example, if you're interested in what the conductivity of the system is. Okay? So that was my 10-minute review of linear response theory. Okay, so now, having motivated the study of retarded Green's function, let me tell you what boundary conditions to impose on the solution of the wave equation in some holographic dual to compute them. Oh, good. Yeah, so good. So the I didn't actually write the Fourier transform slowly. It's from here. It's from the fact that this integral goes up to t. That is to say, I mean, it encodes the fact that the response had better not happen before the perturbation. Right, I mean that's the idea, and so that, and technically it's in here. So in order for this equation to be true, it's important that the integral over t prime, where let's see, oh did I mess up this? There should not be a prime here. Is that correct? Right. The argument, so t prime is the where O sub b is inserted, and so it's important that O sub b is inserted only before O sub a, and so that's what that t encodes, and that's what the theta function encodes. Yeah. Good. Yeah, thank you for asking that. Right, yeah, there was a typo there. Okay. Are there other questions? Okay. I'm not sure when people are supposed to learn this. I mean, I learned this like a few years ago when I was trying to teach myself condensed matter physics. I'd never learned it in like a class. But I think there is a segment of the population of physicists who do learn it in a class. and therefore think it's like obvious that everybody should know. Yes?
I always understood how the retarded and advanced Green functions correspond to physical things, like the retarded ones is like placing a source and then it's generating a...
Right.
And
yep.
The advanced ones like having a current such that you get the source in the future, right?
Uh-huh.
How does the Feynman one?
How does the Feynman one work? It's some linear combination of those that's chosen in some careful way to, let's see. Yeah, you'll notice that I didn't mention the Feynman one. Well, okay, so yeah, I don't have anything intelligent to say about that right now. It's definitely a useful thing in relativistic quantum field theory. But certainly in this context where you don't have to worry about you know, some equation like omega squared is k squared plus m squared, right? Where there's two roots of this equation, and therefore two poles, which you might want to avoid with your contours. It doesn't come up. And maybe someone else has a better answer to this question. I don't know. Yeah, the honest answer is I haven't thought about it recently. Okay, so I want to talk about what boundary conditions to pick on your prescription. What boundary conditions to pick on your solution of the wave equation if you want to compute the retarded response. So this will say which solution to pick, and then it still remains for us to talk about what to do with that solution to get the retarded Green's function out of it. Okay? So right now I'm going to talk about which solution, and then maybe I guess tomorrow we'll talk about what to do with it. So I claim that which solution? The solution which computes the retarded response corresponding to the retarded, that is the causal response, is the one describing stuff falling in. Falling in to the horizon. To the Poincaré horizon. So remember, I called z equals infinity the Poincaré horizon, that is to z goes to infinity. And saying it this way makes it sound quite plausible in the sense that you're used to if you have a horizon in your spacetime, you're used to stuff falling into it rather than coming out of it. And so this is a rather natural claim in that both the thing we're trying to describe, namely the retarded response, and the answer to the question, which boundary conditions to pick, describe things that happen rather than unhappen, like the advanced response or stuff coming out of this horizon. And so that's maybe the best argument for it. You can also check that it gives the right causal structure of the Green's function, it gives the right analytic behavior in the complex frequency plane, and that it's possible to derive it using some holographic version of the Schwinger-Kaldish formalism, which I'm not going to get into. In the ingoing choice here, in the problem that we were solving before this digression of linear response, is the one that goes like, as a function of time and position in the radial direction, it's the one that goes like e to the minus I omega t plus iqz, in the sense that the surfaces of constant phase of this function move towards larger z as t increases. So as t grows, the wavefront moves to larger z. That's what I mean by ingoing. You may not care about real-time Green's functions in the vacuum of the CFT, but the same prescription that stuff should fall in also works in the case that we'll describe tomorrow of the case where there's a black hole in the bulk. And the horizon is not the Poincaré horizon, but the horizon of the black hole. And there it's even more plausible that the causal response should correspond to the boundary conditions of describing things falling in to the black hole rather than coming out spontaneously. Should we stop for today? Thank you for your honesty. Okay.